Hello and welcome to The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, where we explore the culinary arts in and around the greater Lehigh Valley. I'm Mike Drabenstadt, your host for our gastronomic tour of our region's amazing food scene. I'm here with Michael Adams from Hotel Bethlehem in the historic downtown area, where he heads up the 1741 on the Terrace and the Tap Room, as well as the hotel's banquets and private events. Michael, welcome to The Inside Dish.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How'd you get into the restaurant business, and specifically, what drove you to become a chef?
I've always enjoyed being in the kitchen from a very young age. I pretty much knew, eight, 9 years old, that this was what I was going to do because I've always enjoyed being in the kitchen.
So it wasn't being a football player or a fireman or?
No, I was pretty much, straight arrow towards becoming a chef. So I knew from a very young age.
And how'd you take that early passion and have it grow?
So I attended the Culinary Institute of America in 1989 and graduated in 91. I think that had the, I think of all of my experiences, that had the greatest impact, obviously. You know, it was the greatest culinary school in the country, probably one of the top ones in the world, and that's where I really built my foundation.
And what was your first gig after that?
So actually the farmhouse back in 1991, I had eaten at multiple restaurants in the valley, and that one just stuck out. I actually got the job through a former bakery, Matilda's, bought a birthday cake there, and I said, are there any restaurants? And they said, the farmhouse, you should go over and talk to the chef. And I went over there, and he didn't hire me right away, and I waited, and they finally hired me, and then a year and a half later, they made me head chef there. He had left. So I basically took my first chef position at 21 years old and haven't turned back.
And that was then in the mid-90s?
That was early 90s. That was 92 through, 1995. That was an incredible experience.
And tell me, in your opinion, how the food scene in the Lehigh Valley has evolved then over the last, 23 years, or 20-some years, I should say.
Sure. I certainly think back at that point, there were, obviously not as many restaurants, and it was still in that kind of, very basic, fundamental restaurants. I mean, there were a lot of, even at that time, there were Dutch restaurants here, and there were, you couldn't find a sushi place, maybe one. So I think over that time,
No doubt.
And it has grown dramatically and better quality, with all the restaurants. So it's kind of, and now it's, even the farmers back then, there weren't a whole lot of local. There were, but there weren't a whole lot, and certainly not certified organic farmers. So that in itself has grown in the last 20 years. It was actually interesting to watch. The sad part is to see some of them go. It's a tough thing to do.
Most certainly. So you've been in the kitchen more than 20 years, and you've had time at the farmhouse and some other restaurants in between. And now you have a somewhat different gig. You're at the Hotel Bethlehem with a couple restaurants there and banquet and food service. It's a lot more complicated and a lot larger responsibility. Talk a little bit about how that's different than having a restaurant like the farmhouse.
Sure. So I think the biggest difference is, in a hotel, you have this, huge clientele base that all want different things. So you're trying to please every guest that comes in there. So we have we have two restaurants, and we have, combined almost 40 items on both of the menus. And then you have room service, and that's just the restaurants and room service. And then you get into the weddings and the banquets and the corporate events. So you have all of these different things going on and trying to create something that's pleasing everyone. When I had the farmhouse for those 10 years from 2000 to 2010, we would do a 12-item menu and put all of our energy into those 12 items and only doing it 5 days a week for dinner. So it's like you have all this spread out energy over 24 hours a day, and you have to keep the food at a really high level. And that, I think that's what's similar, is that, you know, striving to keep that level of quality at a really high level, even though you're doing that great volume of business.
And how are you able to integrate some of your culinary artistry into the menus that you have now, knowing that you have somewhat more narrow parameters?
Sure. So I think that, you know, the inspiration from ingredients, I think that's where I, you know, when the seasons changed, we still cook seasonally. And we're buying locally. We are, you know, and we're able to change the menus, you know, 4 times a year. And then we're always running, you know, additions or specials to the menu, you know, every week. So that just kind of keeps that, keeps the edge going, you know, and keeps the energy going. And, you know, the staff is incredible. You know, we have a really good foundation there, and you know, you have to continue to push and build onto that.
And how would you describe the cuisine at 1741 and also the tap room?
Sure. So the tap room is basically, you know, American classics. So, you know, as we were speaking earlier, I was telling you that, you know, we have, you know, our biggest selling item is fish and chips in the tap room. And but that's not to say that we can't be creative there, because we had this duck ramen dish on, and we did duck confit and a Korean barbecue, and, you know, all these fresh crispy vegetables in it. And then so we do get creative, but we still have those basic, you know, American classics. And then in our 1741, that's where we mostly do, you know, the seasonal menus. And again, we're executing menus that the guests are demanding. So we have, you know, our prime New York strip steak, and we have some really nice and prepared very well. And then we have, you know, our seasonal section of the menu, where those things are changing all the time.
With the seasonal items, we were talking a little bit before about sourcing and how people like to see that things came from a local farm that maybe they've passed on the road or they're familiar with. But it presents a challenge to someone like you, who often has to produce large quantities of food for a lot of people. How do you go about sourcing and finding the farms and finding the people who are going to provide you with great ingredients?
So I'm still buying from some of the farms that I bought from when I was at the farmhouse. We have to use more farmers because of the volume of business we do. So, you know, we get certain things from certain farmers, and they all do something really great. And we try to fine tune it, the ingredients, and really find the best that each one grows, and then we'll buy those ingredients. And then we use, we're using collaborative in, out of Lancaster called Lancaster Farm Fresh. And they are, you know, 90% organic. And, you know, so we buy our organic eggs for Sunday brunch, and they're coming out of Lancaster. You know, it's really hard to find someone who's going to be able to supply us with, you know, 60 dozen eggs for one day. That's a small farmer. So I kind of have to spread that out.
Well, you mentioned brunch, and even before you got to Hotel Bethlehem, the hotel was known for having one of the most extensive and delicious brunches in the area. Talk a little bit more about brunch, what your view of it is, and how you integrate some of your touches into the brunch there.
Sure. I think that, you know, the thing that I introduced was, again, the locally sourcing. So having the organic local eggs, you know, on the brunch, on the omelet station, and then, you know, continuing to evolve the dishes and not doing the same thing all the time. So we're really, really focused on, you know, it's very limited this time of year, but we can get beets. So we focus on doing a few things with beets this time of year. You know,
what are some other things people might find at that brunch table?
So we do, you know, we'll do like beet and goat cheese salad with micro arugula. And that's something else that we can get this time of year. So we'll do it with a little bit of micro arugula and some goat cheese. And then, you know, we'll do different, you know, pasta dishes and chicken, and we do, you know, smoked seafood and things like that. Now, you know, our carved prime rib of beef that we have on the menu is not local. It's not grass-fed. That is kind of a commodity item, but people really like that high fat content and that cut, and people love it.
Now, are there some ingredients or preparation techniques that you see kind of up and coming in 2018 and beyond that have maybe been underserved in the last couple of years?
Off the top of my head, you know, one thing that we're doing, I can't speak for, you know, the rest of the industry. We're, you know, sous vide cooking has been around for a long time.
And can you explain what that is for people?
Sure. So you're essentially cooking a protein or a vegetable or even some dessert sauces in this water bath. So it's a circulating water bath, and you're cooking at the perfect temperature. You know, so for example, if we're cooking a piece of beef, and we want it to be a perfect medium rare, we're cooking it for an hour and a half or 2 hours at that 124 degrees, and it's perfect. And you can't contest the science behind it. And the texture is amazing, and it's tender, and then the ingredients you add to it when it's in that water bath is just permeating the whole piece of protein.
Let's talk a little bit. We have around 2 minutes left about pairing food with beverages. I mean, back in the 90s, we were talking, there was maybe a limited selection. Now you might have 10 or 15 beers on tap. You have wines from around the world, and you have bartenders that are making up all sorts of concoctions. For diners, does that give them more opportunity, or does it make it a little more challenging, do you think?
I think sometimes it's both. I think sometimes having these grand cocktail lists, you know, with 70, 80 different cocktails on there, I can't even imagine being the bartender there. But challenging for both. One, for the customer to pick something from a list that, you know, that large, and then the bartender to execute that. I think that's challenging for both. But it's also given people the opportunity to try something different that they never had. So that is definitely, you know, it kind of goes both ways.
And even on the beer side.
Oh, even on the beer. The beer, it's overwhelming. Like, the amount of good beers that are out there, you know, and the number of beers, it's just overwhelming.
And even local wines, too.
Local wines.
Yeah.
It goes on and on and on and on.
Well, Michael, thank you for your time. Best of luck at Hotel Bethlehem with all of your endeavors there.
Thank you.
I'm Mike Drabenstadt, and this is The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon.
In 2018, WDIY is celebrating 23 years on the air. If you listen to WDIY, support the station by becoming a member today. Members are our most reliable source of support, and we couldn't be here without you. To become a member, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Hello and welcome to The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, where we explore the culinary arts in and around the greater Lehigh Valley. I'm Mike Drabenstadt, your host for our gastronomic tour of our region's amazing food scene. I'm here with Jim Yerge from Yerge Brewing, a microbrewery just off 5th Street in Emmaus, about a block south of Main Street. Jim, welcome to The Inside Dish.
Thank you.
Jim, you're one of a number of homebrewers who have decided to scale up and turn a hobby into a business. Tell us first how you got into homebrewing, and then explain your rationale for taking that next step, if in fact it was rational.
Sure. So I started homebrewing back in the 90s with my brother-in-law. At the time, we were living in Montreal, and he was living in this area in Wind Gap, and we both decided to do it and kind of try different recipes, you know. And at the time, there was not quite the diversity of ingredients available that there certainly are at homebrew stores today. But we did it for a number of years, partly because, you know, we wanted to try it. We wanted to be able to get beer. We thought we could do it less expensively, but it turned out, you know, that wasn't necessarily the case, although we were making relatively good beer. At some point, it kind of slowed down, and I kind of took a break, partly because I could afford good craft beer, and there was now a lot of good craft beer available. And that was probably the main reason. And then later on, you know, about 15 years ago, my son's were getting close to age of alcohol consumption and bought me a beer kit for Christmas.
It got you right back into
it,
right?
Yeah, and mostly because they wanted to learn. And I still had all the equipment after we had moved back to this area. And we started homebrewing, and we've been doing it ever since. We actually have a tradition that we brew, homebrew together between Christmas and New Year. Actually, last year, 2017, was the first year we didn't do it, and that's because the brewery had just opened, and we decided to get together and actually brew at the brewery.
And the brewery's been open for a year and 4 months now, right?
Just about, yeah. It was September 23rd was the official opening back in 2016.
And for you, what was the most challenging part of scaling up from your homebrew experience to more of a brewery that you have there in Emmaus?
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the brewing aspects of it were not a huge challenge. I did hire a consultant. So Joe Prococo, who's the owner of Soul Artisan Ales, and had been the head brewer at Funk at one point. He and I talked quite a bit before I made the decision to make the jump. And I then hired him as a consultant because I had no clue which equipment to buy, you know, exactly what I needed to do. So when it came to aspects of the brewery operations, he really helped me out a lot. I would say actually the biggest challenge in opening it was the fact that I had never worked in a small business, obviously had never run a small business. I had no retail experience. As I tell people when they come in, you know, the first night we got done the end of the night and I had to close the register and I really wasn't sure what to do. Fortunately, we have a distillery right next door in Triple Sun Spirits, and I walked over and talked to Chris Quant there and said, "Hey, Chris, what am I supposed to do with a Z-Report thing?" So it was interesting, and it's been evolving as I've learned to work in a small business environment.
But I imagine it's challenging and evolving, but also rewarding in a way that your corporate work before that maybe wasn't.
Yes, and okay, so I was I did work at Merck. You know, people ask what as a research chemist, I was at Merck and Company for 24 years. The first 10 of them, I mentioned I was in Montreal. We're up in Montreal. And then 14 years here in the States. And it was rewarding there in the sense that I was, you know, I was discovering drugs, helping to discover drugs, which was very rewarding for me. At the end, you know, as Merck was going through all kinds of restructuring and so forth, it got a little bit more challenging. And that aspect of big corporate was not as much fun. Certainly it's very rewarding, and you know, people come in and you know, I'm almost always there. I've started taking Sundays off, but you know, Thursday through Saturday, I'm pretty much there. And I think that's one of the aspects of the brewery that people like, is they get to meet the owner. And I was the brewer for the first, you know, 6-7 months we were open. And then hired my son come back from Oregon to join me. But it's rewarding that, you know, I'm making it happen and people are enjoying it. They see me smiling. They say, "You're having a good time, aren't you?" I say, "Yeah, I'm having a great time."
Well, I know that's just part of your personality. Every time I've been there, you've come to our table, you've talked to us, and I see you kind of making your rounds and talking to people.
Yep.
You would do that regardless, but I imagine there's a business benefit to that also in terms of people consuming the beverage, having a relationship with the person responsible for making it.
It's interesting you say that, because that's actually the number one thing that, you know, when I sat down and said, okay, what do I want to make this small brewery, you know, what's going to be important to me? And a comfortable atmosphere, you know, in terms of the seating and how things are laid out, as well as people feeling comfortable with the bartenders, with me being there to talk to, was something that was very important. And I think that, you know, my wife and I have talked about the fact that I spend a ton of time there when we're open. But then we look at the reviews and what people talk about, and you're exactly right. They like the fact that they get to talk to me. They hear stories from me. You know, I end up telling the same stories over and over, but most of the time people don't seem to care.
Well, you're only 16 months into it, so
we'll
see what happens.
That's right. And there are new stories, you know. We still have new stories coming.
Well, I know we were talking about you being in Emmaus, and you're about a block away from Funk, which has been there for several years.
Yep.
And there's talk about Cave Brewing opening up in Emmaus also. So
Cave has actually already gotten all their approvals from the borough. And of course, they're already a licensed brewery, so they don't have to go through any of that work.
So here we are, a borough of 15,000 people with three breweries, which as a beer consumer and lover, I love it.
It is great.
So it has to be kind of positive, or is it a mixed blessing for you to have that sort of concentration in a small area?
Oh, I think it's absolutely a blessing. I think we're a long, long way from being at a saturation point in the valley in terms of breweries. And like you said, there's going to be three breweries within walking distance. Maybe in the winter, it'll be a little bit longer to walk out to Cave, but certainly in the, you know, spring through fall, all three will be easily walkable.
Or bikeable.
Oh, certainly bikeable.
Yes.
But you know, easily walkable most of the time. And I think that people will come there because of that. I know that we get people coming from New Jersey and up in the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area all the time because they say, well, we can get two for one with us and Funk.
Three, and now it'll be three for one.
Exactly.
Excellent. Talk a little bit about the beers you brew and the styles that you look to bring to the people who come to the brewery.
Sure. We try to have a diversity of styles, so we don't focus on any one particular style or a, you know, alcohol level or whatever. So we have, you know, we usually have about three IPAs on out of a taps of eight, you know, or a double IPA, Hoptiliacious, some other IPA, and often usually a session IPA, so something lower alcohol. And then the rest of the beers, we try to mix in some darker beers. All the other beers tend to be not hoppy from the perspective of the beer drinkers. And we try to stick with styles that are, I hate to say they're traditional styles, but they're closer to the, you know, the style as you would, you know, normally see it. At least that's what we've been doing to date. So we don't get into adding all kinds of wacky ingredients. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with doing that. That's just where we've been. And we've actually explored styles that neither my son or I have brewed before. Things like a, you know, British mild, or, you know, a Baltic porter, which is actually a lager, which our first Baltic porter is due to go on this week.
Are there styles that you think are underrepresented these days? I mean, a lot of times I go to a brewery and look for a brown ale, and you just can't find them.
Sure.
And I know everywhere you go, there's an IPA on, which right. There's this big IPA kick that's been going for 5 years now.
Well, or longer.
Or longer.
Yeah, and again, we do try to get that. I mean, you know, people have come in the winter and we have our Imperial Stout on. They say, oh, I love your Imperial Stout. I said, don't worry. There'll probably be one on all summer long. And there was. We actually do have a brown ale on right now, Bank Street Brown. And that's actually been really well received. We're doing an alt beer just went on this past week. Again, a style neither my son nor I had brewed before, but we wanted to try it, and we're pretty happy with how it came out.
I think it's important for people to know that there are different styles beyond IPA.
Right. Yeah. IPA, stout, porter, you know, there's lots of different things. And, you know, we've done a couple different styles of wheat beers, and we're actually going to probably be brewing our American wheat again soon. We have a Scotch Strong Ale. That's not something, you know, or wee heavy. That's something that a number of places do, but, you know, we enjoy that. The customers certainly enjoy it.
Well, with 6,000 breweries, I think we just hit that in the country now within the last couple of months. How is it finding the ingredients you want, especially hops and barley that are probably more in demand than they ever have been?
Yeah, barley has, I don't think, ever been a real issue in the craft brewing industry. And we certainly haven't really had much trouble getting ingredients in that respect. Hops are more of a challenge, and they were certainly a challenge a few years ago. And the reason for that, going back to your comment about IPAs, is just that. And in particular, there was a huge shift over the last 5-8 years to hops that are added late in the brew, which are the ones that you sense when you drink a beer first, you know, the aromas and flavors that you get up front. Those are, you know, the really juicy things and, you know, very intense types of hop flavors and aromas. Those hops traditionally had not been the vast majority of what was being grown. And it took a while for the hop farmers to shift to being able to do that. I think that shift is there. I mean, if I recall correctly, and I'm not 100% sure, but if I recall correctly from last year's Craft Brewers Conference, I think they said that things are settling down in terms of the supply of hops. Now, that's not to say that there's not particular varieties of hops that suddenly everybody loves it and it sells out quickly. And hops come out once a year. They come out in the August-September time frame, and whatever crop there is for that year, that's it. And then it gets sold over the course of the year, typically, but some will run out sooner than others.
Jim, real quick, we have around a minute left. You started in home brewing. I'm sure there are people out there considering getting into home brewing themselves. What advice would you give them to start?
I would say, you know, what I always tell friends and, you know, that want to homebrew with somebody else first. It's you know, it's real easy to do that, even if you're doing it with somebody who does the somewhat more complicated all-grain brewing. It's not really that much more complicated. That person can tell you basically when you get to the point of the, you know, you've got all the mash moved into your boil kettle, this is where you'd be if you were doing an extract brew. It's really simple. It can be very inexpensive to get started with it. The other thing is local homebrew stores, such as Keystone Homebrew in here in Bethlehem, always have classes. You know, it's a good idea to take a class like that as well. And then once, what I've always done with friends is they come to my place and brew once, I go to their place and brew once, and, you know, I've actually gone out with them when they shop for the equipment, and then go and help them set it up and brew once. And after that, people, it's pretty simple. If you can cook, you can homebrew.
Great. Hey, Jim, thank you for joining us here at WDIY and sharing your story about Yurgi Brewing.
You're very welcome.
I'm Mike Dravenstad, and this is The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon.